We welcome you to Press Row, a TxAgs produced podcast with local media, and it is episode number 5 as we're rolling along in the 2020 edition of the season and the podcast. And we take a big in-depth look back at A&M's 41-38 win over number 4 Florida Saturday at Kyle Field, the first top 5 win in 6 years. Got to go back to that 41-38, same score, win at Auburn in 2014, first home win against a top 5 team since Reggie McNeil and the comeback against number 1 Oklahoma in 2002. It's been a while. There's rejoicing in the streets. Will that be rat poison or not? We'll find out. We got another game. You turn right around, play another tough game, go to Starkville. So we'll get into that. And a reunion with the Pirate this weekend in Stark, Vegas. Press Row and all TxAgs podcasts are found at TxAgs.com/podcasts. iTunes, or all kinds of different podcast players throughout the internet world, and however you prefer to access podcasts, we're probably there. I'm Gabe Bach, joined by Olin Buchanan of TxAgs.com, Travis Brown of the Bryan College Station Eagle, Brent Swernerman of the Houston Chronicle, and we welcome back a former regular on the Press Row, but he's so busy being national, we're welcoming him back for the first time this year, Slamming Sammy Kahn of ESPN.com. Guys, how are we doing today?
Great.
Doing well.
Sam, good to have you back, man.
That celebrating in the streets afterward, that was all socially distanced, correct, over at North Bay?
Oh, with masks, for sure. Yeah, outdoor preferable.
After what I saw at Kyle Field, I'm positive of it.
Exactly. Travis, welcome back. How you doing?
Hey, can't complain. I want to see those streets that are inside, though. Those are the ones I'm really interested in, so...
That's right. All right. Olin, it's only been about 3 hours. You still doing good?
Man, I'm ready to go. Doing well.
Sam, you win background award over Travis. Travis has been undefeated on background here at Press Row, but I think you got him this week.
Yeah, solid.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I had to do this last summer for whenever we do College Football Live or Find Ball or whatever. And they said just have something, you know, that looks presentable on television rather than just a blank wall. So I spent some time and some effort together, and it's worked out pretty well.
What are you trying to say? You have an issue.
You have a plaque back there.
I do.
It looks okay.
That's right.
You got something. Right. You just got to have something to bring some life.
I like how your head is perfectly framed.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. That was actually intentional. I did a thing where they told us don't cut your head off. So those two things above my head, they said make sure that doesn't split your head in half. So I moved those up because those used to be further down, but after I was told, hey, move those up so they don't touch your head, I was like, okay. So I moved them up, and here we are.
Brent, I believe you call that a humble brag, right? He had to do that for College Football Live on ESPN because he's so popular.
I always thought my two ceiling fans in the background kind of took the cake, but I guess I'm going to have to work on this.
The blue wall and the ceiling fan is strong with you, Brent. It's strong. Let's do it. Hey, let's start back. Let's look back on the 3-point win over the Gators. Let's start there. We'll dive into you guys' individual storylines in just a minute. But how about the big picture? How badly did A&M need a win like that? It's been a while. How bad did Jimbo need it? And do you feel like this could be a launching point, a turning point in the program under Jimbo Fisher? Sam, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think it was necessary, and I think it was huge for the program and for Jimbo and everything that Texas A&M is working towards in the national perspective. That Jimbo is looking to build this program for the long term to succeed, to compete for SEC championships. And in order to do that, you've got to show that you can compete and beat some of those teams. His record against ranked competition coming into that game was tough. Obviously, they played a lot of top five teams in that stretch, but 3-8 was just not a good looking mark. And we're in year 3, you want to see some progress. And the taste that was left after the Alabama game, where you felt like you played well for some stretches and you were competitive early on, but then the game kind of got away from you. You really wanted something positive to hang your hat on, because if you didn't, I think you were concerned about what way this thing could go. This is such an unpredictable year, and I thought it was important for
Sam?
Them.
There we go.
What's up?
I think we got you back there, Sam, and we lost you for a minute.
I think it was important for them, not just in terms of from a national perception, but just for the team to believe, hey, we can go out there, go toe-to-toe with some of the best teams in the country and beat them head-to-head. And for Jimbo's ability to build this program and get them to where they want to be long-term, they have to have that confidence. And I think that Florida game gives them that confidence.
Yep. Brent?
I'm not going to lie. And at 28-17, I think the score was, and the Aggies looked as sloppy as I could remember. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is not going well. And I said, you know, I put out there on Twitter, this is their most undisciplined, you know, product since when? And Shireen Williams chimed in with ever. You know, she was pretty fired up at that point. But I'll hand it to them. I'll give them credit. They scratched, they clawed, they stayed with it. They're fortunate that Florida's defense is pretty bad. But, hey, bottom line is Florida came in number four in the nation. The Aggies stuck with it, stayed with the plan, stayed, you know. Kyle Field was loud for being a quarter full. One of my questions, and maybe y'all have an answer for this, is how much do they pipe in sound? I've never kind of gotten a good answer on that, but mainly because I haven't really asked. But bottom line is it was huge for Jimbo to kind of show. It's what Olin and the rest of y'all talked about last week. Jimbo needed that to show progress. It wasn't necessarily, you know, a must win or do or die or anything like that. But he needed to show Aggie fans, with everything that's gone on in the offseason, the four touchdown loss at Alabama, that this program is indeed headed in the right direction. And that's what they ended up doing at the end. And he was quite fired up afterward. You could tell it meant a lot to him, not only to get that win, but also to beat Florida once again.
It's the perfect Travis Brown sidebar/column on MyAggieNation.com. What's the percentage of piped in crowd versus natural crowd? I mean, this is what Travis is known for, these kind of stories.
I walked by Olin at the game the other day and said that this game is not a game story game. This game is a sidebar game because of how many different little aspects of that game went right for A&M to come out with the win. I was going to say exactly what Brent said, in that just look at Jimbo's reaction that went viral all over Twitter afterwards, and how fired up he was. And it could be that he won his first top five matchup in eight tries at A&M, or it could be that he beat Florida, a team that had some rivalry action against him at Florida State. Either way, you can tell it meant something to this team. I think that I want to compare me and Cease were talking about comparing this one to the Kentucky win in his first season, which was also the next highest ranked win under the Jimbo Fisher era. And in that one, it was big, but Kentucky's strengths played right into A&M's strengths. They had Benny Snell, the top tier rusher, going in against a great rushing defense. This year, A&M had to beat a number four Florida team that their strength played right into what was their perceived weakness, and that was passing defense. And they did what they needed to do to be able to give the offense, which also was a little bit shaky, a chance to win a shootout. And I think there's something to be said about that, as far as if you want to look at most impressive wins under the Jimbo Fisher era, that he had the strategy that came back and they executed in a way that they necessarily haven't in the last season and a half to win this top four matchup. I think there's something to be said about that.
Oh, and that Kentucky win was impressive, but Kentucky just doesn't just roll off the tongue, right? As a blue blood, Florida, because of Spurrier, has become a have, and then what Urban did. I mean, it's a championship program. So they got name and clout, and all of a sudden it helps your national perception when you go beat a team like that.
Yeah, but now I would say that Kentucky team was better than a lot of Florida teams we had seen in recent years until yep. now. And that Kentucky team was really good, finished, what, with 10 or 11 wins and beat Penn yes. State in the bowl game. So that was a big win. But, you know, what I thought was so important, not just the win, but the way in which A&M won the game. And I'm talking about making the big plays. The one thing that they really didn't do against Alabama, because they moved the ball against Alabama. But what a difference you saw on fourth and two. And fourth and two against Alabama at a key juncture, Anaya Smith drops a pass, and it, because of that, it turns into a route. I mean, not the only reason, but instead of being down maybe 28-21 at half, you're down 35-14, and everybody knows it's over. This time, on a fourth and two, Isaiah Spiller scores a touchdown, and you ride that momentum into a win. So, and even before, even after that, you know, the big third down completion. So instead of kicking a 52-yard field goal, you end up kicking a chip shot field goal. A&M showed growth not only in going in and going toe to toe with a ranked team, which they've done before, but came up short, Georgia and Clemson a couple of years ago, but making the key plays. That, I think, is where you really get a lot of confidence and a lot of growth, is that not only did you win, but you made the clutch plays at the clutch time to be able to pull it off.
You know, we're going to get into a lot of individual storylines, which are going to involve the run game a lot, but we couldn't go too far into this thing without talking Kellen Mond. If we get into all our individual stuff, we might miss it because he was Kirk Herbstreit's National Player of the Week, and rightfully so. He was tied for with Najee Harris for the SEC Offensive Player of the Week. Guy was 25 of 35, threw for over 300 yards. No turnovers. He was decisive. He threw for 3 touchdown passes, converted on third down. How good was this far and away, Kellen Mond's, Sam, best game as an Aggie from start to finish?
My opinion, absolutely. Because of the magnitude of the game, the caliber of the opponent. I mean, we can talk what we want to say about Florida's defense, but that's an SEC defense, regardless of how they may have played. And A&M deserves credit for making the plays. I look at the throws that he made downfield to Caleb Chapman, mostly in stride. I look at some of the tough plays he made in critical situations. And I think for Kellen, for everything that he's endured from a criticism standpoint, from his play, the fan base, the, you know, things that have happened in the offseason, you know, from stances he's taken, he's aware of, you know, how people feel about him, you know, good or bad. And I think he understands that this senior season of his is really important. He's trying to cement his legacy as a Texas A&M quarterback and help this team take it to some heights that maybe it hasn't been in a while. And in order to do that, you've got to play like he did on Saturday when the chips are down against really good teams. And I thought he balled out. He had his best game as an Aggie, in my opinion.
Brent, what'd you see from number 11 on Saturday?
I think one of the most impressive things is what Sam just mentioned with – saying Caleb Chapman, you're talking about he lost his main security blanket in Jamon Osman. We all wrote about it. We all talked about going into the season. That Mond-Osman connection had gone on since high school. Suddenly he loses him, but yet Kellen turns around and has his best game with what's still a young receiving core, unproven receiving core, however you want to call it. You know, and it's really unfortunate what happened with Caleb Chapman because you could really see that chemistry starting to develop, that connection. That guy was impressive in the game with the, you know, with especially on that final touchdown catch where he did everything he could to haul it in and ends up hurting his knee and it's out for the season. I would say that was part of the, you know, the biggest part to me that impressed me about Kellen. And also, I'm personally happy for him. I don't know how y'all feel, but he's always good with us. I've always appreciated Kellen's approach with the media and his sincerity with us. So in a situation like that, I was personally happy to see the way he played. And to kind of unload some of that burden off his shoulders like he did with such really, really good performance. And what I think is his best, obviously, in 4 years as a starter.
If you want to look at it statistically, the second best passer rating game, save for Mississippi State last year. But like Sam said, you look at the magnitude, you look at the opponent, you look at the pivotal nature of this game in the season where things could either start snowballing downhill or this could be the start of something really great moving on. And yeah, of course it has to be his best game. The thing that really stood out to me was one of the problems he's had in years past is he's connected passes receivers, but it always seems like if you would have hit him on the outside shoulder instead of throwing it a little bit low, they get 5 more yards because they can turn with it instead of having to slide and secure it. And today or Saturday was the game where he, for the most part, led his receivers in the right place, threw some strikes, and let them get some yards and do some stuff with it afterwards. That really stood out to me. His accuracy, and there's accuracy, there's completing the pass, and there's accuracy where you get the ball where the wide receiver can do something. And the latter kind of accuracy is something that he actually had this game that has been missing in a lot of, even some of his good performances in years past.
I think he nailed it, Olin. It's like command versus control for a pitcher. He had total command of the offense in the game.
Yeah, we've seen Kellen be have a spectacular game before. I always think about that Clemson game a couple of years ago. But the difference in my mind, obviously, that they won besides that. But look, as good as he was against Clemson, let's be real. There were a couple of plays that he got really lucky on, a couple of touchdowns that were very fortunate bounces that he went his way. I don't know that there was any flukes at all in this game. He didn't have to compensate by running. He ran a little bit, but he didn't have to. But he threw guys open, it appeared. But more, but what Jar is saying is, yeah, I like that. What you, the command and control thing, he was very accurate, more accurate than I've ever seen him. And yeah, I think it was the best game he's ever had here.
You can't do a podcast, Sam, featuring Travis and me, even though Brent's the one that actually played.
Without Travis making a baseball reference?
Yeah, oh, yeah, we're going to have a baseball analogy in this place somewhere. I just promise you. So I was just the first to do it. We'll probably have another one. So let's get into yours, Sam, your storyline, because a huge part. Now, Mon helped out the run game, but without the run game, we might still be searching for A&M's identity coming off two straight losses.
Without question. I think, to me, their success running the ball was probably the most important factor in them winning that game. For this reason, I'll say, when they're down 28-17, what did they do on that next drive? Hand off to Spiller, hand off to Spiller, hand off to Spiller, hand off to Anaya Smith. They went, I think it was 7 straight run plays on that next drive. And that's that juncture in the second half when you're down by double digits where a lot of coaches – want to throw the football because, hey, we're in the second half. We're down double digits. We've got to catch up. There's that propensity to go away from what you are as an identity offensively to try to throw the ball and get yourself back in the game. Jimbo's offense works best when they run the ball. When they've won games in his tenure, they've averaged 41 rushes per game, 238 yards per game in wins. When they've lost, 28 rushes per game, 88 yards rushing per game. That's a huge difference. And I know it's obvious to say if you run the ball better, you'll win. But the way that offenses are these days, not everybody runs a style of offense like Jimbo Fisher does. So the run game is that much more important. It's not as important in the run game to Mike Leach at Mississippi State as it is to Jimbo Fisher at Texas A&M. So in order for them to succeed, in order for Kellen Mond to be able to have the game that he had, they've got to be able to run the football. And I think that drive when they were down 28-17 was a statement drive for that running game, that offensive line, and this offense to be able to say, hey, we're going to do what we do. We're going to assert our will. We're going to go score a touchdown and make this a ball game.
Guys, we were in the press box. I mean, could y'all feel it, or was I just down the way a little bit and felt it all by myself? But I felt an identity being formed on that very drive when A&M just handed the football to Spiller and used physicality up front and got that thing done. And he was amazing. Spiller was so great in the game and finishing off his runs and run very hard. I felt like A&M created an identity finally in this offense this year.
And that identity maybe could be whittled down to one play or one moment when Spiller trucked that linebacker Miller. That was something else. I know some of the old timers remember Ben Bolina doing that in the Florida game back in 2012 as well.
Partially old timers.
Yeah. So that was quite a moment. If I'm not mistaken, it was on that 4th-and-2 in the 19-yard touchdown run, and he just blasts that guy. And if you say, if you're looking forward and saying, hey, that was their identity, I think say that might have been the exact moment it started being formed as well when he did that to that linebacker.
Well, I think that drive really came in huge too, because that was the drive following the drive with the 2 personal fouls that they scored on, where things seemed to feel like they were getting a little, like Brent was saying, they were getting a little bit out of control. And I think, Brent, that was about the time that you sent out that tweet when it starts off with they seem to get a stop on the drive, but Michael Clemens gets the illegal hands to the face. And then Leon O'Neal comes in late on a little bit of a skirmish. Next play gets burned on a touchdown pass. Just these penalties that continued to extend the drives. Jimbo Fisher came back out and said, okay, we're going to take this thing by the reins and control this game again. And yeah, for all the momentum that could have shifted because of these fouls, whether they were merited or not, whether, tempers were flaring, it kind of just calmed everything down, settled it, and pulled the momentum back in favor of the Aggies. And I think that was huge, especially in that point in the game for what had happened in the drive before.
OB?
Well, it was definitely the created identity for that game and showed you what they can do. As far as if it's going to be their identity moving forward, I don't know. Maybe their identity is, that they can adjust to whatever needs to happen for them to be able to win. Are they going to be able to run the ball like that? And are they going to want to run the ball like that the rest of the season? I don't know. But they were awful good at it at that time when they needed to be, and that's what they needed to do to win. So we'll find out if that's their identity, if they're going to be known as a physical power running team that throws off of its success, builds its success in the air off of what it does throwing, running. We'll find out. But for that game, big game, that was the right thing to do at that time, and they executed it marvelously.
Well, and Brent, let's go to your storyline, because a big reason why Olin's not jumping all in with 2 feet is because it takes the boys up front, and that's been a real maligned group, Brent, but they were fantastic on Saturday.
Yeah, you want to fire up Jimbo Fisher, criticize his offensive line. And I know y'all remember this from a couple years ago when it had the offensive line. And he said, well, how did Travion Williams set the school's single season rushing record? But, you know, he wouldn't have been able to do that with the offensive line. Then this week, boy, he was going down the list of how many things can happen wrong that are not the offensive line's fault when people criticize the offensive line after a sack. Now, I think one of the most amazing stats of the past two games is that Kellen Mond was not sacked once by Alabama or Florida. That all starts up front. And I'm going to go back to when I first started covering the Aggies in 1995. And R.C. Slocum, it was a different time. You know, it was an informal gathering. Olin remembers this. We would, after the press conference, we'd kind of just sit around in the old Kane dining hall and talk football. And I never learned more football than in that stretch from Coach Slocum. And I remember him talking about how an offensive line, there are no quick fixes on the offensive line. It's something ideally, even the stud recruits, you want to ideally redshirt them, get them in the nutrition center, pack them on, and get that pipeline going. And I know this has been a criticized group, but you're talking about four senior starters, five-star in Kenyon Green, who's been excellent, you know, at left guard. And it's all come together. Josh Henson, the offensive line coach in his second year. And I thought that was really neat, the way Ryan McCollum, just his heart seemed so warm when he talked about Jimbo running the ball on fourth and two instead of just trying to throw it or on third and three in situations like that. And, of course, they ended up getting the touchdown. So that's been one of the best stories three games into the season, is how this offensive line has come together, has stayed together, stuck together, was one of the worst last year, no matter what Jimbo says, but 2.62 sacks per game, 107th nationally. I'm sure there were a lot of factors that went into it. Right now they're tied for third nationally in sacks allowed, one through three games. And it's been pretty remarkable what this veteran group has done. But going back to what Coach Slocum said back then, I think you're seeing that. And Jimbo, in response to Olin this week, talked about how this very mature group has come together at the right time and in its final season together as well.
Let's toss that around. What do you guys think? Are you guys believers in this offensive line moving forward?
It's hard not to believe. Yeah, we're talking about one sack. What, Florida had four sacks in both of its previous two games. And you know, A&M moved the ball against Alabama. Some seem to forget that. Now, maybe after what Ole Miss did, it's not as big an accomplishment as it used to be. But you know, they moved it against Vanderbilt, and then would trip all over themselves. So I think that obviously the offensive line is playing really well. Why? Okay, they're coming together. They're older. They're healthy. Kenyon Green is a much better player than he was. You know, there's a myriad of reasons why you might point out, but the bottom line is they're just better than they were, and they've got to continue to be better.
I think the season and the way that the teams they've played has kind of fit well into building a foothold into the season. Vanderbilt oftentimes only rushed three people and gave them some time to kind of get a flow into things. At Alabama, the game plan, at least for the start and through the most of the game, was quick throws, give the offensive line a little bit of a reprieve from having to pass block for deep passes. Now, they lost that game, so you can argue if that was the right play call or not, but it kept Kellen off his backside. And then last week, they really, really did a good job of picking up blitzes, whether that was Kellen in the backs or McCollum in the line finding those, picking them up, and Kellen threw well into the blitzes too. That really opened things up. So yeah, I'm a believer. I kind of lean towards Olin when he was talking about if this is the identity of the team, to see if Florida was not a good defense statistically and by the eye test, and if they're going to be able to be a good run blocking offensive line. I think that there's still a little bit of something to be seen there against maybe a little bit stiffer opponent on the defensive side of the ball. But yeah, if you compare this to the last couple of seasons, this is a very much improved offensive line, which is more impressive coming off a year with no spring practice and limited fall drills, limited summer workouts, because we were all saying that they're not getting any resources, like Brent said, coming in. This is going to be an offensive line that has to improve as a unit as it is. And they did it seemingly kind of on their own because they didn't have that spring ball and summer workouts were truncated.
Sam, 122 career starts, I believe, is the number amongst that group. I mean, once you get to that point, you've almost seen anything a defense can throw at you, no?
No doubt. And that experience helps. It matters at that position more than any other because of the nature of the defensive front you see in the SEC, because of the nature of the position itself and the amount of cohesion you have to have from position to position along the offensive line. I think it's super important. And I think what we saw them do on Saturday was so important because, again, a confidence booster for this group. I'll throw a number at you as I pumped into my old fancy ESPN statistical database here. Yards per carry before contact. They're averaging two yards per carry before contact, which is second best in the SEC. It's 12th best among Power 5 teams in the country. So right now, that means that they're getting at least 2 yards off the line of scrimmage before anybody touches the ball carrier, which is pretty good. The national average among the Power 5 is 1.7. So they're definitely above average. They're in the top 12 of Power 5 at this moment. So that tells me that the guys up front in the run game are doing what they need to do to make some holes for the guys in the backfield.
And I'll throw my handy-dandy piece of paper at you and say you add that to Isaiah Spiller, first in the SEC, yards per carry, 6.9, 5.57 yards per carry after that contact. That's first in the SEC, and he's broken 17 tackles so far this year. That's also first. Olin.
I just want to throw out one more stat, and that stat is zero, and that's how many penalties that offensive line drew against Florida. No holding, no false starts, no – I don't know if they can be involved in illegal shifts. I guess they could be. None of that. They played about as clean a game as you could ask them to play.
They're really
Gabe. Dead. Gabe, yes, you sir. Still printing things out?
Yeah, I am. I got paper all over the place, man. Look at this.
I will say, in the press box, y'all know what I'm talking about here. In the old days, last year, whenever, all the paperwork that's just constantly coming at you.
Love it.
And it doesn't happen anymore. I don't miss it. You know, everything's at your fingertips. And I'm just giving you a hard time about that print now. I got things in front of me, too. So
I love that he had it highlighted. I'm a big highlighter guy. When I'm prepping for games and I got my notes, I'm highlighting a bunch of stuff.
Highlighting like a son of a gun. I got brackets.
Looks like a research assignment.
It is. Robert Cessna about, 6 years ago, printing out his MapQuest directions to
Wait, we don't do that anymore?
What's the problem with that?
Yeah. MapQuest. You got a problem with MapQuest?
Somebody's going to screenshot that of Gabe's, what he just held up, and it's going to be like, pick up kids at 3. And
that's true.
Do laundry.
Spank kids at 3:30. I'm just kidding. All right, so let's do –
Yeah, we're just having a little fun here, no?
Oh, yeah, I thought we were. Travis, special teams.
Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of people, I think we've even talked about it on here a little bit, the fact that the last two games, A&M has one kick return for 3 yards. It's been a lot of kickoffs, a lot of waves for fair catches, and a lot of starting the ball on the 25. And where I think it's frustrating a lot of people because A&M has been a program in the recent history that games have been changed and momentum has been shifted because of kick returns and punt returns and their ability to have a pretty good a special teams unit. But you saw the mistakes against Vanderbilt. You saw what the safety, some of the things that happened with returning it, and they've gone away from returning the ball. We asked Jimbo about it this week, and he said it's because they're kicking the ball off higher than ever. It's getting the defense on enough time to get down the field and cause some havoc. And if you have a guy who averages a 25-yard return every return, well, he's going to be one of the nation's leaders. So why not take it? I just argue, and I wanted to kind of pitch to y'all, yeah, I get the logic of that, and I get some of the teams that you're going against, but I think we kind of thought that, okay, it's Alabama. Their special teams unit, they're usually it's Alabama. So okay, let's get back into the rhythm of things. Fair catch, start on the 25. See what we can do with that if you're the Aggie coaching staff. But what I thought against Florida, which whose defense is has been a little bit subpar, that A&M would try to maybe break one off or two, and it just isn't happening. I kind of wanted to pose to y'all, do you think that this is one of those cases where Jimbo Fisher is kind of stuck in his thought processes, and if he can get the ball at the 25 and start the drives there, then we're good to go? Or is it something where they're building their special teams up and building confidence and building some looks because fall camp was weird, and by the end of the season, A&M will be returning some of those kicks? It is returning kicks in college football with the way they're kicking the ball and the way they're covering kicks. Is it worth it anymore?
I'll take a little bit of that. I think one of the points of logic for Jimbo in this is, if you know his history, he's generally risk averse. You know, he's a guy that's going to go for fourth down a little bit less. He wants to be, I think the way he calls it, aggressively intelligent. You know, he wants to take chances, but he wants to be smart about it. I think at this point, given what you said, the backdrop of everything that's happened this offseason and the unpredictable nature of everybody's training camps, things of that sort, I assume he probably, with a fourth-year starter quarterback, he probably feels better about his offense and more confident about, you know, Isaiah Spiller in that running game than he does, you know, in the return game at this point. And like you said, when you have the high kicks, if, you know, a lot of this is database. If you feel like those high kicks are going to yield more often than not a small return, then why not just take the yards while you can get them and trust your offense to go do it?
I think he's not a one-size-fits-all kind of guy. And he's going to look and see, maybe this year is going to be different than last year. He had Deshaun Corbin back there for a while last year, right? Returned his opening kickoff for a touchdown against Arkansas. I think if he feels like he has the guy that he has confidence in, and maybe a team that they're looking at and say, I don't think they're very good on kickoff coverage, then I think he's going to try to return it. I think if he looks at, and I got to be honest, I don't know what Alabama and Florida's coverage teams are like. I did not do that much preparation to check that out, but he probably did. So, yeah, I think it's going to depend on, A, how he feels about his guys back there, and then B, the specific team's coverage. Now, he may take he may fair catch every kickoff this year from here on out, but I bet you next year when Devon Achane's back there returning them, he's going to let him return kicks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And are we surprised that we haven't seen Achane yet?
Yes.
Kicking, especially if, I mean, you talk about not having your guy, is this, in essence, redshirting Achane to this first season and letting some guys who you know can just catch the ball, take it and get it? Will we see him? I, this whole kickoff thing has been a little, I mean, we all know, like you said, Jimbo is intelligently aggressive, but this seems intelligently conservative.
To Travis's point, I mean, if tackling's so bad, then wouldn't you might maybe take a few more risks and think you might break one, the risk reward, but the reward's there. And this year, tackling's really bad across the board. And do you feel, though, Brent, this might be a little bit of knee jerk because of how overly aggressive to a fault they were in the first game? Maybe you said, look, forget it. We're just going to go Kellen Mond from the 25 after Vandy.
Maybe he's seen some things in practice where some guys have had trouble hanging onto the ball on the returns, on the hits and things like that. And he's just going, hey, let's set up at the 25 and go from there. I did want to say, here's my special teams contribution. How tense would that crowd of 50,000, and I'm joking when I say 50,000, Kyle Field, if Seth Small had not squeezed in that extra point at 38-38, and then he's setting up, and it's not just to break the tie, it's for the win on that field goal at the end. I think that was something at the end where, you know, obviously they felt fortunate to get that extra point, because suddenly things really tense up if you're down by one as opposed to tying that. So, you know, he seems like, you know, he had a after missing the field goal at Alabama, obviously a confidence boost and everything, but that could have been bad as well on that extra point. They felt fortunate to get it over that crossbar.
Well, and you talk about that third down play to get him a 26-yarder instead of, what was it, like a 52-yarder. That's a 52-yarder coming after a point after that you almost doinked off the crossbar because you shot it into the offensive line. So, I mean, yeah, that's even more huge when you look at it in that context, that if you're going to come off of what was almost a catastrophic mistake to get a 26-yarder instead of a 52-yarder, it's huge.
Yeah, it was a huge play on on that third down to move the sticks right there and to put it in the hands of your quarterback and Chase Lane to move the sticks. Because then if you incomplete that pass, 52-yarder with a minute left, he probably misses it, let's be real. And then they got a timeout with Kyle Trask and Pitts and Tony needing to go 25 yards, and their kicker's awesome. So you probably lose the game if you don't make that third down conversion.
Hey, how about Buddy Johnson? You know, here's a guy who back in camp, he sees this starting linebacker opt out. He sees some fellow veterans, some seniors opt out. He posts, I'm 1,000% committed. And here's a guy as a senior creates that fumble at midfield. Loyal pounces on it, and the Aggies are in business. That was pretty to see, and it should inspire younger people to say, hey, good things can happen if you stick with it, and you'll have some really, really great senior memories.
And you know what I was most disappointed about on that play is that DeMarvin ran into Buddy after he picked that. After watching the way he ran with that interception last week, I wanted to see DeMarvin run with it. But it probably – yeah. Now, it probably would have been what's the word I'm looking for? Probably wouldn't have worked out. I can't think of the word I wanted the way he wanted to, because he might have scored and left enough time for Florida to go down.
He had it all planned out.
Yeah. But
counterintuitive. Anyway,
meant to do that, like Pee Wee Herman.
But it's easy to like Buddy. It's easy to root for.
Yeah, yes. We're giving defensive shout-outs, too. How about Keldrick Carper? You have Leon O'Neal, who gets that two 15-yard flags in the game, the second which led to that score where he got burned on. And then Keldrick Carper comes in, a guy who is a senior, who is a captain, who's doing a lot of stuff with programs and stuff within the athletic department, too, who – has kind of just had to wait his turn behind these younger guys. He came in and I think was a little bit of a calming force on that defense. And he was a guy that when things were getting chippy, he was in there pulling people off, telling them to cool down. And you know, you can say what you will about maybe these younger guys beating him out for the position. He wasn't a liability out there. I think he was a really good calming leadership presence in that defensive secondary. And he stayed out there for, I believe, the rest of the remainder of the game and did a good job.
Sam, I wouldn't be surprised if all Keldrick Carper starts. A, he's probably a little more sound than Leon, but B, he plays a lot of dime, and I imagine you're going to play a lot of dime against Mike Leach.
Yeah, because Mike Leach doesn't like to run the football. And so you're going to have to – I mean, the blueprint's been put out there, you know, so far, at least so far, on how to beat KJ Costello and this Mike Leach air raid team. So until they prove otherwise, I think you put a lot of DBs out there, cover all the receivers, and let it go.
So let's close with that. I'm in a reunion with the Pirate, and he's been a thorn in A&M's side for 20 years. And we see, remember all the A&M got him a few times. They lost to him more. And really, wins over A&M in a large part led to a lot of his rise and getting that program to where he got it. I mean, they got to number one in the country at one point, right, in 07. And then what he did, some incredible moments at Wazoo. He's already had one incredible moment at Mississippi State and a couple clunkers. That's what he does. You just don't want to be on the clunker side of this thing. So what does A&M do defensively to try to do like the blueprint that Arkansas and Kentucky showed you and Washington showed you many times to try to shut down a very potentially explosive attack that can be prone to some bad days here and there too?
You force him to run the football. If you get your guys ready to cover and make him run the football, because it's this one thing, you know, you talk to people who, you know, to Leach himself and the people who've known him, people who've scouted him, defended him. He is one of the more stubborn guys out there when it comes to his scheme. And he, you know, Lincoln Riley has evolved the run game in the air raid. Dana Holgorsen has evolved the run game in air raid. Mike Leach hasn't. Mike does what he does. It more closely mirrors what they did in Kentucky in the late 90s than any other air raid coach out there right now. And so I think you drop your guys, you play a lot of zone, and you make them run the football. And if they run the football, then you adjust. But until he proves that he will do it, and until KJ Costello proves that he'll be accurate and not make mistakes like he did with six interceptions last week against Kentucky, I think you that's the game plan you stick with if you're A&M.
How frustrating is it to be Kylan Hill right now, where you're touted as one of the best, if not the best, running back returning in the country, and Mike Leach comes in and shows that maybe this could be what is great with that first game, and he has a lot of receiving yards, but then all of the pressure then is now going to be on him to run the ball, and it's just not a system to be able to do that. I mean, his season stats, 15 carries for 58 yards and a 3.9 average.
Yeah, he's been banged up too. But yeah, you're right.
He got hurt early against Arkansas, but he had 15 catches last week, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's still getting the ball in his hands. It's just the Leach way of doing it. I'm not going to toss it to you. I'm going to throw it to you.
Mike Leach story, 2007, and they sent me on a Big 12 tour. No, it's not 2 o'clock closing time call.
Keller smoking hot chicks.
Yeah, that's not the way. Coach, another one? No, it's not that story. It's he let me follow him around at a practice in 07, and this was in training camp. And he had a little piece of paper, and he just observed everything, and he wrote just little bitty notes on that paper. And at the end of practice, he called those guys together, and every once in a while he would glance down at that little paper. But his recall on everything kind of reminds me of Jimbo. Jimbo has amazing recall as well, which I'm envious of how they can do that. It was incredible how Mike Leach was able to sit there and recall everything that happened in that practice, and using very little of the little bit of scribble he had on that piece of paper. So he's a remarkable offensive mind, but I will say this, all of those things being said, how many conference titles does Mike Leach have in 20 years of coaching?
Well, none.
Because people figure him out along the way, you know, and he has – it's one of those things. I covered the 05 after the 05 regular season, the Cotton Bowl, where Alabama just stifled him. Because they had great athletes on defense, and they figured out his offense – I think the final score was 13-10 Alabama.
Yeah.
So field goal limped through. What's that?
The field goal limped through.
Yeah.
On the last play of the game.
He can be figured out. And if you have really good athletes, if you're recruiting the type of defensive backs, and obviously that hasn't shown up the past couple of games that Jimbo is right now, but I predict he will have future success against Mike Leach if he continues to recruit the way he is, especially in the defensive backfield.
All right. Let's go around the horn with this question. We'll close it out. Travis, you're first. Does A&M cover the 6.5 on the road in Stark Vegas this weekend? Yes or no, and why?
Yes, because I think they win the game. I think that I just think that like you said, they'll throw a lot of defensive backs out there. I think that they've proven against Florida that they can stop that kind of attack. And I think that the defensive line is going to get a little bit more pressure in there on Costello for some disruption. They'll get some turnovers, and turnovers will be what will give them the offense the needed separation to be able to be comfortable.
Brent.
A&M's riding a big confidence boost after the comeback against Florida in Mississippi State. Now Mike Leach is being Mike Leach, talking about purging the program and doing all that pirate stuff, having them walk the plank. So, yes, I do think the Aggies go into Starkville, and I do think they cover.
Olin, when you throw one touchdown and 7 picks in 2 games, you walk the plank as a quarterback. What do you think? Does A&M cover 6.5?
I'll put it this way. I would say yes, but I wouldn't put on any money on it because I've gone to Starkville too many times looking at an A&M team that should win easily, the stats indicate, and lose. So do I think A&M's going to win? Yeah. Do I think they're going to win by more than a touchdown? Yeah. Do I think enough to put my money on it? No, I don't think I would do that. But nope. I would think that they're looking at the LSU tape a lot and say, this is what we're not going to do. We're not going to play man coverage all game. And then, you know, it's a good coaching staff. They have good players. And quite frankly, I think A&M has more good players. I think Travis is right. I look for A&M to Costello to get more pressure against A&M than he's had. I was watching some of that game, that left tackle for Mississippi State looked kind of vulnerable to a speed rush. Michael Clemens.
Sam, 25% capacity, Sam, means 50% cowbell because they'll be double-fisting, and that's giving A&M's receivers fits in the past. Yeah, you can gift that if you want.
We got a gift of that,
Air league. Cowbell. Yeah. But hey, and that's given you fits in the past. We've seen it too many times, but nightmare spot for A&M, Sam. Do the Aggies win and cover the 6.5?
Yeah, I think they do. I think the confidence that they're riding with is important. They're just flat out a better team. It's a better roster. Jimbo is 3-1 against the Mississippi school since he's gotten A&M. I think this is a game that they go in, do what they have to do, take care of business, they cover.
Where was that Excellent. One loss?
It was at Mississippi State, but it was two 2018. I think this team's a little different and a little bit better than that one.
Hey, what was that 2016 team?
Hey, what did Jimbo say? He likes the cowbells on the farm, not so much in Davis Wade. Yeah,
that's right. All right. Exactly. All right, guys. Well, enjoyed it very much. Sam, welcome back. Let's do it again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, guys. Good to talk
to
you.
All right. Excellent. Thanks to Sam Kahn and Travis Brown and Brent Zwerneman and Olin Buchanan. And thanks to Jamie Mari and Dalton Hughes for producing the program. And you for tuning in to another edition of Press Row Podcast. It's A&M in state this weekend, 3 o'clock on Saturday on ESPN. We'll be back to break it all down next week. Press Row Podcast on TexAgs.com.